Good afternoon. Welcome to High Notes. For our radio audience, we are coming from Christ Episcopal Church, which is in the west end of Aspen, Colorado, and I am with the always wonderful, irrepressible Orly Shaham. Orly really probably needs no introduction in Aspen, but I'm going to ask her to give us one anyway. Orly, who are you? Why are you here?
You know, my son's been asking that same question about himself lately. He says, who am I and why am I not someone else? Who am I and why am I here? Well, I'm here specifically in Aspen for a number of reasons, some of which have to do with music, but a lot of which have to do with Aspen. I've been coming to Aspen for close to the last 40 years, and given that I'm not quite 40, that tells you something. Because my father used to work at the Physics Institute every summer, so I came here as a very young child, and I was thrilled to see my kids when we arrived late last night having the same experience that I would have every summer as we turned every corner going to our lodgings. They said, oh, I remember that. Oh, I remember that. Oh, I remember. Oh, that's a new building, which happens a lot here in Aspen. So that's my Aspen connection. But I was a student at the festival for 400 or 500 years, I think. And I was very lucky that I pretty much went right from being a student to coming here to perform. So in my entire lifetime, I can probably count on one hand the number of years that I have not been in Aspen in the summer.
Well, we're thrilled you are here. Your teacher was Herbert Stussen?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, great.
My teacher, the very first summer that I was here, my teacher was Nancy Stussen, Herbert's wife, and she had gotten a position here before she had it anywhere else in New York. So I think I was one of her first official students at the Aspen Music Festival. We prepared for my Juilliard pre-college audition here. And I even remember those practice rooms, which no longer exist in the same way.
Yes. happily, I think, but anyway. And actually, many people will remember that your husband, David Robertson, music director of the St. Louis Symphony, proposed to you on stage in the music tent.
Well, now technically he proposed off stage, but then immediately announced it on stage.
That sounds safer.
But I must say that over the years, the number of people who have come to me all around the world and said, I was there when your husband proposed. It's mind-boggling. The tent must have been packed that day.
And you just told me something I didn't know, which is that he bought your ring here in Aspen.
He did. He has two sons who at that time were, I guess, about 9 and 10 years old. And the only time he had to go ring shopping was when I would take them to the pool. So he made 45-minute excursions to the various jewelry shops here in Aspen to find this beautiful engagement ring, which you, of course, can't see over the radio.
Well, terrific. You are, of course, here to play a concerto on Sunday, and we're going to talk about that in a few moments. But I thought first we'd ask you about some other projects that you have, concert projects, recording projects, writing projects, presenting projects.
I am nothing if not projected, right? Well, I was lucky enough to be here in Aspen in the winter this year, playing a recital in February, all based on this repertoire that I've just released in a 2-CD set called Brahms Inspired. This has been a big project, a couple of years in the making, in which I recorded some of the late solo piano music of Brahms, along with music that inspired him and music that has been inspired by him, including a couple of commissions based on his music. And that's been just a kick. The CD finally released about a month ago, and people seem to be really interested in it. And what I love is people are writing things like, this makes me want to listen to more late Brahms, which is, frankly, the whole point of the project.
Terrific. And you've also presented several times in Aspen a program for very young children called Baby Got Bach. Tell us a little about that and how that came to be.
You know, I started Baby Got Bach because when my own twins, who are now 7 3/4, when they were about 3, they had aged out of those sort of mommy and me music classes. And there was not that much of high quality in between the ages of 3 and about 7. You know, from 7 on, a lot of the symphony orchestras or the large presenting organizations have family programming. But that sort of preschool age was really lacking programming. And that's luckily changed a lot. And even just in the last 5 years that I've been doing Baby Got Bach, but I decided since there wasn't a perfect thing to take them to, I would just make one. So we started this concert series in New York. We started in a bar, which is a perfect place to send your three-year-old. And over the years, we've moved. We're now presented by the 92nd Street Y. We've been there for a few years. And we've also expanded. We've done a number of shows here in Aspen. We've done some shows in St. Louis and around other parts of the country. And the idea is to get the kids excited not only about making music and feeling what the instruments feel like in their hands, which they really do, but also excited about listening and understanding that listening is a reward in and of itself, which is, I think, something that's always been difficult for kids this age, but in today's generation where everything is visual, it's become even harder, and you hear teachers complaining all the time, well, kids just don't know how to sit and listen. Well, they're never going to really know how to sit and listen because that's how they are at that age, but I think what our program does is it engages them in a way that they feel like if they do listen, something cool will come out of it. Some reward will happen, and we do that through all sorts of compositions where they're rewarded through a particular movement that they do based on the listening, or we do lots of things that are sort of age-appropriate, animals or little handkerchiefs that they march around with, things like that, to get them really engaged. And Baby Got Bach has become kind of a little side obsession of mine, this whole idea of getting young people excited about music. You know, we're talking always kind of a perennial discussion about the aging of classical music audiences, and people say, well, let's bring in the 30-somethings. Well, let's bring in the 20-somethings. And I say, let's bring in the 3 to 6-year-olds. And because if you don't start there, we really aren't going to have a whole lot of interest later.
Well, bravo. It's a great project. Now that your twins are getting older, is it going to be Children Got Tchaikovsky or Teens Got Thomas Tallis or what?
I'm going to just put this little tease out there that when we do Baby Got Bach here in Aspen this summer, one of my sons has finally learned to play on the piano, a particular piece that I tend to always play for these shows, and he has put in a request that if he's ready that I would let him perform it. So I'm just saying that maybe on August 14th, Alex Robertson will make his Aspen Music Festival debut.
Okay, let's let the radio audience know. August 14th, out on our Buxbaum Teaching Campus, at what time?
I think it's 10, 11? It's okay. In the morning, for sure.
It'll be on the calendar.
It's for kids. It's in the morning.
Yeah, excellent. Great. Seriously, though, following on what you said about listening, I'm more and more convinced that we should not apologize for the fact that what we do in classical music takes time and preparation and listening. We shouldn't say, oh, no one has an attention span anymore, so we should abridge Brahms' First Symphony. It's 46 minutes long. We should make it the length of a tweet or something like that. And I think we should instead embrace this fundamental aspect of the art that we practice and say, okay, everything else can become fleeting, everything else can be multitasked, but what we do cannot be, and that's what it is about.
You know, and I think in the visual arts, it's not like museums apologize for their size and say, oh, I'm so sorry, it's going to take you an hour and a half to walk through our museum. And the difference in museums is that every person can take a slightly different amount of time at each painting, right? So nobody has to spend the same amount of time for each moment, which is not a luxury we have in music. In music, the time goes the same way for everybody. It passes in the same way. But at the same time, you don't see museums saying, well, this week we have a special exhibition, 3 paintings only, be out in 15 minutes.
That is funny, although I confess that when I have the luxury of being, say, in New York for a while or in Paris for a while, I do go in and just look at one thing and really concentrate on one thing, and then go take a break. So, but it's germane to our topic later in this program about Stephen Mackey's new concerto, which Orly is going to play on Sunday at 4, which is that if you're in a concert and a piece begins, you are most likely going to sit there and listen to the whole piece. You don't get to come in and out. I mean, please don't, if you can help it. So let's maybe shift gears and talk about Stephen Mackey a little bit. I'm going to give some background from my point of view, but more interesting will be the story of how you came to be involved in this piece. When I was an undergrad at Princeton University, it was a very legendary time, and the great figure was Milton Babbitt, and sort of the whole musical universe seemed to revolve around him. And it was a very great experience working with him. When he retired, we all thought, what will happen now? I mean, how can anyone inherit this tremendous mantle? And it turned out the person who did was Stephen Mackey. And he was a very young person when he first went there. He came out of a world of rock music, as did Christopher Rouse, who has spent a lot of time in Aspen, and as have done now a lot of major American composers. And by his own description, he went through a very abstract phase of writing music. I think sort of wishing for the classical, as opposed to his rock background, and now has entered a very beautiful, important phase. He's about my age, I think. Let's not say what that is. So still very early phase in his writing, but music that has a lot of emotion, a lot of narrative, music that reaches out to the listener, excuse me, and the piece he wrote for you is certainly in that category. So first I want to just give a commercial for Stephen. It's really wonderful music, and it's music that if you give it attention, it will give you back meaning. And then ask Orly about this piece and getting to know Stephen.
Well, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head with his background. His music spans the centuries. He's an incredibly skilled composer. It's like, you know, when you're looking at the sort of the very young Picasso, his drawings, those were the ones that were completely not at all foreshadowing what would happen next. And you just see the level of technique, the basic things that he can do, the virtuosity of his painting. Steve is the same way in his virtuosity. So the concerto, for example, ends with this enormous triple fugue. Now, there really isn't anything that's more difficult to write from a sort of compositionally virtuosic point of view than a fugue. A double fugue was what Mozart put in his Jupiter Symphony to show how incredible he was. Well, this is a triple fugue. And it's intricate, and it's beautifully crafted, and just the skill and the layering and putting it together and the different orchestral instruments with the piano make it hugely, hugely satisfying to play and I think to listen to as well.
I'm just going to jump in and say, for those who don't have Wikipedia right in front of them, single fugue would be one theme which is treated in a repetitive, imitative, very complex way. And a double fugue is there are two themes simultaneously being treated in that form of imitation, and a triple fugue means three different themes happening all at once.
And it's a lot to just to make those fit together in a way that they logically work and that they work for the ear and for the emotions is an incredible feat. So he's got that in his writing, but he also has this background of having ingested all of the late 20th century different forms of music. So he's got all sorts of rock and roll influences in the piano, and the piano part has influences really from so many different pianists and their styles, and including his own love, for example, of listening to recordings of solo Bach on piano. So there's some of that as well, but even to the point where when the piano first comes in, it's very Thelonious Monk. It's he calls them these plunkety notes. I remember when I was first talking to him about the piece, he said, "Come in like you're playing with all thumbs." And there is something in that kind of Thelonious Monk feel with that tongue hanging out of your mouth. And maybe we could listen to the very opening of the piece just to
sure.
hear
Absolutely.
What that sounds like. And you were talking about openings and a piece getting your attention. Well, this piece, the opening is probably the most out there part of the entire concerto.
Now, do you want to tell the story, or do you want to tell it after this?
Let's start with listening to the opening, and we'll listen as far as where the piano starts coming in, very plunkety or so. This is stage one. Thank you. So you hear how the pianos just come in with these very odd chords. They don't seem to mean anything. They don't seem to come out of what's happened before. But what he's done, a very clever trick, it sounds like the piano's out of tune. There's something that sounds, and it almost has the feeling of like a toy piano. Something's not right with the piano, and he's done this by a very cool compositional trick. The very first note of the piece is played by the double bass, but it's not a typical note. It's what we call a harmonic. So it's a note where you haven't pressed down the string all the way. Those are a little bit different in their tuning than the notes where you do press all the way. And he's had the entire orchestra, all the string instruments, which can change their pitch readily, he's had them all match that slightly out of tune double bass note. So that in fact, as the audience, we all think that that's in tune, and that when the piano comes in, the piano's the one out of tune. Yeah. But it's the other way around. And the piano and the harp kind of go back and forth, exchanging these notes, like, well, who's right? You know, what is reality here? And part of the sort of the programmatic story of this is, I think you probably heard in the beginning that the celeste plays this beautiful little theme, this which sounds somehow like a lost nursery tune. I don't know where it's from, but there's something, it comes from your childhood, it comes from, it's like one of those mobiles spinning around, or there's something very nursery atmosphere about it. And in fact, the piece the conceit of the piece is that in some ways, stumble to grace is what all little humans do as they first learn to walk. Steve talks about this, that he was watching his son, Jasper, who is similar age to my twins, so this was a real sort of bonding experience for us during the compositional process. He was watching his son, Jasper, learn to walk, and he realized that essentially learning to walk is learning to fall. It's learning that as you drop that next foot down and it falls, the ground will be there to hold it back up. And it's that series of kind of stumbling as you fall which eventually leads to you being able to run around, to a kind of virtuosic display whereby you can handle metaphorical triple fugues. And the piece, it doesn't exactly go chronologically through that development, but it is in stages. There are five stages to the concerto. And this first one is very much the nursery stage, you know, the kind of things spinning around you in this dreamlike state.
I'm going to do two quick detours, if you'll forgive me. One is that, if you can believe this, a few years ago I was learning to do inline skating, what used to be called rollerblading. And the person teaching me, the first thing he said was, first you have to fall. So put all the pads on and just fall, like flat out, because you cannot be afraid of that when you're doing this. So I thought of that. The other is a little musicology. Any composer beginning to write a concerto, the first thing is, how is the solo instrument going to enter? Because it has to be intentional. There has to be an idea about it. Last Sunday, we had Beethoven Violin Concerto. And then before that, we had Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. So similar period of Beethoven, and yet completely opposite ideas about what the relation of orchestra and soloist is going to be. The piano concerto starts with the piano, and the violin concerto starts with an extremely long introduction before you get to hear the violin. So when you listen to the Mackey concerto, he's fitting the entrance of the piano into a storyline. And I love the trick about the tuning, which doesn't work if you have perfect pitch, by the way.
No, you think, why did the orchestra tune flat? Maybe to just take you through the concerto a little bit, stage by stage. So this is, the first stage has that very nursery-like kind of atmosphere. And it ends beautifully with the piano playing that tune. That da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Actually, doubled with the flute, at least in part of it. Symbolizing a certain maturity on the part of the protagonist. You've come to the place where you can imitate, where you can say back what's been said to you. And then the second stage, to me, the second stage is, you know how when toddlers first really begin to toddle, hence the name, it's very boomy. You know, that these falls on the floor, they're not delicate. There's not a whole lot of grace. There's not a lot of sort of ballerina soft footing it. They just kind of pound the floor as they go. And stage two has this feeling. It has this very complex, it actually has one of Steve Mackey's signature textures, which is cross rhythms. He loves, and this comes, I think, a lot from the rock background, this idea of taking a long, complex rhythm. So my sons are deeply involved in polyrhythms at the moment. They think those are great. To them, a polyrhythm would be something like three against two. So if I were to do three with one hand in the same time that I do two in the other hand, and it would sound like this. So two, one, two, one, two, one, two, two, one, two, two, one, two, two. So from a musician's point of view, this is a very simple polyrhythm. Well, Steve likes to take huge, complex rhythms where one instrument is doing some kind of rhythmic pattern over, I don't know, five measures that divides into 35 parts. And that goes against another instrument that is doing their long rhythmic pattern in four measures divided over 36 parts. It's these kind of mathematical things where, you know, you need somebody from the Physics Institute to actually tell you where they would fit in together. But in fact, they do fit in together, and they fit in very well. This movement is loaded with these kinds of rhythms. And in the very opening of it, he starts it with just the drums. And you almost can't understand, because it's just percussion, you can't understand where there's going to be a melody out of this. And it takes a little while before the piano comes in, and very low in the bass brings the melody that comes in out of this. This is the very beginning of stage two. The strings doing these kinds of big chords and the brass doing these big chords, but underneath is that rhythm. And that rhythm's never stopping in the percussion. The piano takes over with the melody and the complex rhythms at the same time. To keep going all the way to that spot, because there at the end, it's like that rhythm, the cross rhythms, the cross purposes, the pounding have suddenly gelled together, and there's a melody. This ba da 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 da, which to me feels very Rachmaninoffian.
I was just going to say that's a Rachmaninoff melody.
Very endless melody. I refer to Rachmaninoff as endless melodies, right? They never get to the end. They always go to the next thing, and it really has that feel, and it has that feel in the writing. And I think it's soaring. It's that feeling, you know, of mastery. Where you finally have enough control that you can, when you're walking, you're going to get to the place you intend. You know how when kids first start to walk, it's like they're looking forward, but they end up sideways? Or they're looking behind them, and they walk forward by accident? Suddenly it's that feeling of, I can control this, and it's going somewhere, and a big dialogue kind of opens up there between the orchestra and the piano.
No, I was going to say something about Rachmaninoff, but I decided not to.
I see. I could hear you wanting to say it. So this is, and it's terribly complex. And I one thing I have to say about this piece, a number of times during the writing process, Steve would bring me copies of the score as he had it so far and say, you know, what do you think? Is this playable here or there? And generally, everything he wrote, I said, fine, although I have a pretty small hand, and I can only reach a ninth. And only under the right, only if the stars are aligned. I can only reach the ninth if the, you know, Venus and Saturn are in the right place. So there were a couple of places where we switched things around, which he actually liked even better once we did them. But I did, particularly in the beginning of the second movement, I said, you know, Steve, it's really, really hard. And he said, well, it is a piano concerto after all. So clearly I was asking for it. The second movement ends in this kind of giant culmination of all of that rhythmic chaos. And it gets distilled. It gets distilled down to a single note. And in that single note comes the cadenza. And this is unusual. Stage three of the piece is a solo piano stage. So it's essentially the cadenza. It's a good 4 minutes long, maybe even a little bit more. And it has in it a number of influences. One of the stories that Steve and I kind of bonded over early on is I love the cartoonist Charles Schulz. I grew up, first of all, I learned English from Peanuts comics. And I actually thought people said good grief. And I was sure it was pronounced good grief because I was teaching this to myself. And I had the incredible honor very early on in my career to meet Charles Schulz. And he drew a panel for me, which he eventually sent to me, in which Schroeder is playing a little bit of a Beethoven Pathetique sonata. And it was a part, I had told him that I loved to try to guess which sonata Schroeder was playing. And the final bar line has fallen off, so all the notes are falling off of the musical staff with their stems sticking up. And poor Snoopy is trying to walk across the floor, and they're sticking in his paws. And he says, ouch, ouch, ooh, ouch. And so that's the panel that Charles Schulz made for me. And I told Steve about this, and he said, well, you know, I've been thinking about Peanuts and this particular piece and the music of Vince Guaraldi. Now, Vince Guaraldi is the man who wrote the music that always accompanied the... Yeah, exactly. You know, the Linus and Lucy theme, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which my son adores playing on the piano. And he'd been thinking about that jazz influence already in the concerto. Well, sure enough, in stage three pops up a few things that really remind me of Vince Guaraldi and that kind of Peanuts theme. You hear the piano, we might skip like 20 seconds into stage three, where at first the piano is just exploring from the single note, but after a while the pianist has enough confidence to just kind of start improvising on his or her own. So this is in stage three. Thank you. Cadenza continues with that same sort of theme, but now in a different key, because he's also worked out a beautiful way of defining harmony in this just around a particular note. So I think I could see a lot of smiling faces when you hear that sort of Vince Guaraldi moment where it comes in.
So from Rachmaninoff to Peanuts. And I also got some of the opening, the celesta, the sort of music box or mobile.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, there is. It's not like there's an arc. It's not like it goes from infancy to three-year-oldness. It does. It kind of goes back and forth a little bit, both because it refers back to the themes, and I think because as humans we do. That's how human development works, right? We refer back to other times in our lives and to other things that we've learned as we're learning. There's something so intimate and personal about this cadenza. I always feel like, you know, in many ways, a cadenza's point is to show you what the soloist thinks about the themes, right? Or what the soloist is thinking about this particular concerto as it's going. It is supposed to get into the mind of the cadenza. And I feel that Steve Mackey's really captured the essence of a cadenza. You know, it would have been originally really improvised on the spot. And you could hear this has that feeling of, you know, searching, finding your way, and then latching onto a musical idea that you really like and kind of repeating that, going with that and developing it in a very spontaneous way. It's one of the joys of playing this piece. I have to say I have a smile on my face pretty much the whole time when I'm playing this piece, because it puts me into this character who I really adore, who is sort of every child, you know, learning to be a person.
Well, we were talking about the rhetoric of the concerto, and certainly the cadenza is one of the key moments for that. I want to ask you how it ends, because in the concertos we've had, the two Beethoven concertos, the strategy for the end of the cadenza is, again, very different. We had Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto a few days ago, and there's a different, very beautiful strategy. My favorite of all is Ravel G major concerto, but how does this one go?
This has actually a wonderful ending, that the piano is just going off on this idea, and it fades with horns coming in a very surreal sound, actually, again, kind of similar to that opening sonority, that always reminds me of, you know, you remember in the 60s, it was really popular to do those kind of kaleidoscopic things in movies where, you know, those dream sequence sort of things, or like the things in Vertigo, you know, those little scenes. It has that kind of feel, and you almost don't realize that it's ended because you just kind of got twirled around into a different place. And then that the little idea that da 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 da, that little motive that had been in the cadenza, it continues into the slow movement, and the slow movement, which is actually quite short and very beautiful. I asked Steve Mackey what he thought of the sound of it. What was he imagining? And he's a very visual composer. I'm so fascinated by how you composers think about things, what makes you, you know, what inspires you to come up with stuff. So he said he sort of imagined what would happen if you took a piano and you held it up by the bass notes so that the bass strings were kind of hanging down and the smaller strings were hanging a little bit lower, so that in fact it was upside down in terms of sound, that the bass was the loudest, and as you went up in pitch, everything got softer and softer and had a slightly unusual sound because they weren't really connected to the instrument anymore. So that's the kind of sound world that stage four has. And then he launches into a pretty cool finale. Before he has that triple fugue, he has the piano. Suddenly the piano and the orchestra, this is another typical concerto question, is what is the relationship between the solo instrument and the orchestra, right? Is it solo versus orchestra? Is it solo and orchestra working together as an ensemble? Are there soloists within the orchestra? There are a few of that, of soloists within the orchestra in this concerto. But overall, there is a kind of an arc where by the end, the soloist and the orchestra are working together. It's like the soloist finally knows enough to be able to play with others. And we start the last movement with this jaunty little theme that goes back and forth. And I had this great moment when Steve first showed me that movement, and I played through the opening phrase, and it sounded really familiar to me. Much better than I remembered, but really familiar. And I thought, well, what is this? And I realized when I was about 14 in theory class, they asked me to write a 12-tone theme. And I wrote a little jaunty little thing, which was not very good, but in character, exactly like the opening of Steve's last movement. So when I played that for him, and then I played him the little bit that I had written, you know, so many years ago, I said, the minute I heard yours, I knew we were simpatico. There's something that we just get about this mood, this feeling. So maybe we'll hear the very opening of stage five and then just kind of pause at that end before the fugue, where the piano plays this theme and little by little convinces the orchestra that, yeah, you could play with me. We can play together. It's okay. That's kind of the introduction, if you will, to that, to the finale. And you see this great little theme. And one of the things that I love is Steve Mackey's ability to change harmony on you in a way that seems perfectly logical and doesn't necessarily follow all of the rules that you thought you knew. He kind of has his own sound world. But within itself, it makes so much sense. There's one moment in there, which for all of us nerds in the room, where he suddenly goes down to a low E instead of a low C. And to me, it's so satisfying because it's so honest and it feels very personal and it feels just as strong as any harmonic move by Mozart or Beethoven or Brahms, but it's done in a different language. It's done in the language of America of the early 21st century and in a way that makes a lot of sense. And he's also taking this little playful little theme, and so there's a lot of joy in this and a lot of exuberance in this movement. And then finally getting the orchestra really to be playing the game and to be doing the solos. And right around this moment where we stopped is where the triple fugue suddenly starts to emerge out of all of this.
Okay, and if we're going to hear it and you're going to say one, two, and three for the themes?
You know, I can't really do that. It's okay. Not that clear. And the reason is they kind of all come in together.
Okay.
And they continue together. But if you pay close enough attention, you'll be able to hear that the more than one line is repeating itself and imitating itself.
Okay. I'll say a little insider's note is in an earlier part of his life, Steve was married to one of the greatest solo percussionists in the country, and his music always has fabulous percussion parts. So
the percussion players are always thrilled to when I bring this concerto.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll keep listening from where we left off, and I'll sort of let you know when that fugue's really started in earnest. The fugue develops for a little while, and it actually becomes quite big and becomes sort of small again. And here is kind of, to me, the most interesting story about the creation of this piece. Steve wrote this fugue in its totality, and he wrote a beautiful, lovely, very poetic ending to the piece. And he gave it to me, and the first conductor for whom this was written as well is my husband, David Robertson. So he gave it to the two of us, and the two of us were looking at this, and we said, wow, this is just a beautiful ending, but... and it really was beautiful, very poetic, you know, wow, this is humanity, and it kind of ended with a comma or an apostrophe sort of feeling. And Steve came over, and we played through the concerto, and I played as much as, you know, I'd learned at that point, which was not all of the fugue by any means. That fugue took me a long, long time to learn. And we got to the end and played the ending, and Steve could sense that David and I had something to say. And he looked at us and he said, now tell me, you two, do you secretly wish that it had a big ending? And I said, you know, I breathed a huge sigh of relief, and I said, yes! You know, after I've played that enormous fugue, the feat of, you know, mental and physical virtuosity to just put this thing together and all that, I want people to jump out of their seats! And it turned out that was, in fact, the ending Steve had written originally, the big ending. But he did want to try and see if this poetic ending would work, and it's beautiful, it's lovely, and this is what's, to me, is so fascinating about being a composer. I would not have any idea how to choose between those two. But as a performer, it's no question.
Well,
I want excitement.
Digress then for a moment with a little inside story. On Sunday we had Richard Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra. Now this piece famously has a weird ending. And it also famously has one of the greatest beginnings of all of Strauss's works. And there's a reason for the ending, and you can learn the reason. You can say, oh, I understand. And then if you're like me, you say, I still don't like it. I understand why it ends that way, but I wish it didn't. And I was saying this to Robert Spano last night, and he said, you know what we're going to do is next time we do Zarathustra, we're going to repeat the opening fanfare at the end. And philosophically, it's going to mean, oh, it's the circle of life, and the day begins again, etc., etc. But what it's going to be there for is so that the people will clap at the end of that piece. And a parallel story, which you will know, is in Arthur Rubinstein's first book of memoirs. It's called My Young Years. And at a time when Ravel was still living, Rubinstein was very young, and he was touring with the Valse Noble. And this is a fabulous piece, and it has a lot of brilliance in it, but it ends super quietly. It just fades into absolutely nothing. And so in his memoir, he says, so the audiences would go, oh, at the end, and there'd just be a sort of, hmm. And so one time, he just ended it with a big banging cadence, which came out of nowhere. And he said, everyone jumped to their feet, and they were all happy. And then the terrible thing is that someone told Ravel that he had done this, and he got like a telegram saying, don't ever do that again. Anyway, so you got your big ending.
It turns out that Steve is, you know, more forward-looking than Ravel. No, so we got a big ending, and it's just hugely satisfying piece to play. I mean, I've loved it. I've brought it to quite a few orchestras, and I have to say their first reaction, particularly the poor double bass player who has to play that first out-of-tune note but get it correctly out of tune, their first reaction is, what? But after a few minutes, they are just thrilled with it. And it's not only the percussionists who love playing it, but the brass get some beautiful things. The violin section has some great parts, and they add so much to the texture. You know, his orchestral writing is very rich. There are so many lines going on at once, but they really do all serve this one goal of the sound of the piece. I really adore this piece, and I find it very powerful. So I hope when you get a chance to listen to it all the way through, you'll agree.
Okay, so come on Sunday, 4 p.m., and you'll hear the ending. And also on the program is Strauss, since we're talking about Strauss, but Don Juan, a very brilliant piece, and Sibelius, Fifth Symphony. And for years now, people have been saying to me, what do you have against Sibelius? Why don't you ever do Sibelius symphonies? And so here's one of the big ones. On this program, conductor Hannu Lintu, he's from Finland. He's been with us, I think, once before. I do want to have a few moments, if you have questions or comments on any subject for Orly. Yes. Oh, if you don't mind, wait for the microphone, because we're on the radio, and here it comes.
This has been very, very helpful, and it'll help me a lot on Sunday. I'm just wondering how you, who have taken so much time to understand this piece, what you feel like and how you attempt to face on Sunday an audience that's not very sophisticated. I mean, you gotta...
Okay. Sorry about that. I do live here, but I'm not very sophisticated either. Well, how do you face an audience
actually,
like that?
It's a good question in certain ways, and I'll tell you my philosophy on that. My philosophy has always been, whether I'm in front of a group like this talking or playing, that even if my audience isn't as sophisticated on the particular subject that I'm on the stage talking or playing about, they are sophisticated people, nevertheless, and they're intelligent, and they wouldn't be there if they didn't want some kind of intellectual, emotional stimulation. That they're there, they may not know so much about the specific subject, but they're there because they want to enjoy it. They want to get something out of it. One of the things that I love about this particular concerto is that I do find, except for a couple of moments, and even those, if you are open with your listening, it is accessible on the first listen. It's not the sort of thing where you won't get anything out of it the first time. You will get a lot out of it the first time, but like any great piece, you'll get a lot more out of it the second and third and fourth time. And my answer to that always to people is, you know, when I first heard Brahms symphonies as a teenager, I remember thinking, well, I don't get it. But there's something in it that I want to hear it again. And that's true of any music. It doesn't matter where it's coming from. So I think people will like it.
Well, I have a question regarding the importance of starting children out young. I'm from the Chicago Symphony League, and Yo-Yo Ma has started a program there from 3 to 5-year-olds, the Once Upon a Symphony. And the most important thing we can do is start building audience. Start building audience for symphonies, because that is the way that it is going to be preserved. So I'm just wondering what you know about the rest of the country and how they're going to contribute to that important subject.
It's getting there. And I really, like I said in the beginning, in the last 5 years since I started Baby Got Bach, many more programs for 3 to 5, 3 to 6, 3 to 7 year olds have come up around the country. It's becoming a trend, and I love that. But to me, the most important thing is, especially at that age, that it's not just about becoming an audience member, but about starting to learn how to play an instrument. Because, of course, the people who become the most loyal, avid audience members are generally the ones who have had some experience playing the instrument, who have some idea of what it is that's incredible feat that's happening in front of them and what it takes to get there. So I think to have a combination of the kind of the physicality of playing and also listening at that age, I can't emphasize it enough. I think it's huge. It's very important.
And this is why our organization, has started giving lessons, weekly lessons and weekly ensemble to hundreds of children in the Roaring Fork Valley. And we have choirs, we have string programs, and we have guitar programs. And Jazz Aspen does piano and more jazz instruments.
Some years ago, Alan, you gave a talk in Aspen, and you said that the average age of concert goers and opera goers has remained the same for 30 years at about age 55, plus or minus. On Tuesday's free concert yesterday, the conductor's group, the audience were music students and people who were 20 years older than I am, and I'm pretty old. Now, I grew up in New York and listened to, through my mother, of course, I couldn't tune the dial, WQXR. But she took us to see Milton Gross, and I remember Martin Bookspan on the radio and Texaco Opera. And I brought my children up in Chicago, and we listened to WFMT, and I took them to all classical concerts. They have absolutely no interest whatsoever. This is one of the biggest disappointments in my life. One of the question is, will you consider doing what I think Chicago Symphony Orchestra does with young people, where they do what they call a rush, 15 minutes before tickets go on sale at extremely low discounts to, let's say, people under the age of 40. Way discounted. There are a lot of open seats on Sunday, much more than before the 2008 recession. The seats are going empty. The plane is taking off. If you can get $10 or $15 a seat, 40 and under, would you consider that as an alternative strategy?
Well, we think Thank about you. That all the time. We think about it every year. We look at who the audience is. Of course, uniquely, we have free seats at all of our tent concerts because the lawn is free. And we have a lot of younger people who are going out there, and they love it, and they love the social aspect of it. And so when we quiz them, they don't want to come into the tent because they're loving that aspect. And later in life, they'll come in. But
can I just say one little thing on that side? Is, you know, I love classical music, and I am around that. I'm not for long under 40, but I am. And I have a young family, and I have to tell you that unless I'm performing, the odds of finding me in the audience at a concert, very, very slim, because I don't have time at this point in my life, and my kids aren't ready to join me, and it would mean not only the free, but it would mean the babysitting and the this and the that, and I think it's asking a lot of people in their sort of mid-30s to around 50, that age which has now become the age where we have kids of this age, to be the core concert group. They will never be the core concert going group. But if we can maintain them on a low flame that whole time, then when they're ready, they'll come.
I do agree. Okay, we have time for one more question back there.
Hello, I'm just going to stand because I want to see you as I talk to you. Emma Peake have come from the UK to do the PAMA conference up in Snowmass, and I decided to take an extra week to enjoy this festival, which I just want to comment on, is just absolutely phenomenal. It's not really a question as such, but I just wanted to kind of chime in on what you're talking about with the preschool age children, because I've devised a methodology for starting young violinists, which is part of my PhD, and it's called Safe Start, meaning that it's all about the physiological side of things and about listening, developing the ear before the visual comes into play, And I just think it's so exciting to hear what you've had to say about the same kind of ilk. And I think I'm very excited to have been invited obviously to the States and to talk to people that are going to go out to be teaching and to actually give them the ideas, which obviously you're talking about, with really starting them off as musicians from the beginning, not purely technicians, but rounded musicians. And if you can get them from that kind of age group, with my experience, you know, they really do grow up to love music. And as this gentleman said here, I don't know too much about Texas and the States, obviously, but I did find it funny just being in the vibe of everyone laughing. But then I'm not at the age yet where I've seen them progress to that kind of concert going stage, but you can just only assume intellectually that if they're starting to listen to your Bach, as you say, at three, then by the time they're, you know, 13, 23, they're going to have so much more understanding of the music that you're talking
and
about.
And I think the understanding you're talking about, that's the crucial thing, because there are ins and outs, and there are times when they will like it more, and there are times when they'll be free to enjoy it more in their lives. And our job is to make it, to make them understand that it is here, and it is here for them. And that's kind of all we can do. We can't force it any more than that. And so long as the quality of what we do is all consistently high, there will consistently be people who are interested in high quality and would want to come.
Well,
thank you.
I see there are still people who would like to make a comment, but we actually are out of time. So thank you all for being here, and thank you for listening on the radio.
Thank you.